This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine, plus global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Tim Stenovek on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. Happy New Year. Welcome to our holiday weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week.
And Happy New Year to you too, Carol.
You too.
Over the next 2 hours, look back at the year that was.
From the nonstop discussion over inflation and monetary policy globally,
to the crypto collapses and undoing of the individual considered that, you know, the J.P. Morgan of crypto. We're talking about Sam Bankman-Fried.
Mm-hmm, we are indeed. So important was crypto this year. Business Week devoted an entire issue to delve into the crypto story, what it's all about. It's a must read.
Other issues took deep dives into the undoing of Roe v. Wade, the new economy, good business, and more. Many stories this year were about the world's second biggest economy, though, Carol. We talked about it a lot, and its constant impact on everything. We're talking about China.
That's right. More in a moment. And let's not forget the gift that keeps on giving this year. Elon Musk and Twitter, top tech stories in our Business Week Pursuits team. They talk about cars. They talk about museums. That's in our second hour. But on this New Year's weekend, we begin with a thoughtful and an omniscient editor behind it all. He joins us every day on our daily broadcast and podcast. We're talking about Joel Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, along with another key member of the team driving coverage at the magazine, Jim Ellis, assistant managing editor. All right, guys, a lot going on. A busy year. Hard to believe we're at the end of it. So, Joel, when you look back at this year, how do you think about it in your coverage?
Well, there were a couple big themes, and you hit on a few of them there really eloquently. Kind of was preparing for this little conversation with you. I looked back, and one of the first covers of the year actually was about the Winter Olympics. And the cover line was China's Games, and we had a really clever podium arrangement where Xi was at the top podium. And it really did speak to how much the world has changed since the last time the Olympics were in China. Back then it was the Summer Olympics. And that story spoke to how much the global dynamics have changed from those Summer Games to these Winter Games. And it also speaks to China. And that was a bigger story that I wanted to take a couple minutes and talk through all the various facets of what the Chinese economy has been going through, what the people there have lived through, what some of the companies with global exposure and are rooted there faced this year, and also what that means as we start to kind of look ahead.
Let's do that with Jim Ellis. He's assistant managing editor of the magazine. Jim, it's pretty incredible to think about, you know, not just the impact that China has on our economy globally, but the key themes driving our coverage of China this year. If we start with the Olympics as sort of one of the bookends, what's the other bookend at the end of 2022?
Well, at the end of 2022, it's the idea that after a year of following a COVID zero policy where they've been willing to effectively shut down their economy off and on throughout the year. And since they're the world's factories, shut down factories for the rest of the world, they've suddenly decided, okay, we're cool. We're going to go ahead and open up. And it's turning out that the reopening of China after COVID is going to be just as difficult as dealing with COVID. I don't think people really understood that. They didn't expect that. And it's sort of turned out to be sort of a shock. It means that 2023 is not going to be this sort of joyous sort of bounce back, you know, in China and for all the people around the world, the companies around the world that depend on them to do manufacturing are still going to have a hell of a time next year. One of the things that surprised me was, just a few years ago, we always talked about if China ever sees growth go below 7%, you know, oh my God, you know, it's the end of the world. mean, China this year is probably going to do about 3.5%. That is amazing. I mean, you've basically seen the growth there slow dramatically over the last 4 years, and they're not ready for that, but we're probably not ready for that either.
Well, you know, it's interesting, too, and I think about, you know, coming off the pandemic, globalization, pushback, supply chains, like there's so many issues that go back to China. And I think about also something that the magazine covers so well, and that's Tesla, and specifically its exposure to China and what that means going forward. I mean, China, if the economy opens up, good, but also bad because of concerns about global inflationary pressures. But if it doesn't, what that does to global demand and global growth. Like it's
investors have already sort of awakened to this when they've been pulling Tesla's share price down, in part because of danger of Chinese business there dropping. I mean, we've seen, I guess recently, Tesla saying that it might lower production at the Shanghai plant by 20%. This is the first time this plant has ever gone down from its maximum capacity other than when they shut Shanghai down for 2 months. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is an amazing thing to see this happen. And after months of basically having to wait forever to get your Tesla, Tesla is able now to provide you a Tesla within 30 days in China. There is no backlog. In other words, the business that is, you know, for them in their second most important market is truly slowing down. And we haven't seen that before. Something is going on there. And because they depend so heavily on China,
right,
not just for serving the Chinese market, but also for exporting to Europe, this is a bad thing for Tesla.
What about when it comes to competitors to Tesla in China? We often talk about them in the context of hundreds of different companies. But one of them in particular that a story that you edited this year about BYD.
Right. BYD, which is broader than just electric vehicles, but it's a massive producer of electric vehicles. It is, Berkshire Hathaway supports it. They have a big investor in it. And it is, it's turned out to be a very big supplier there, a real competitor to Tesla, but also an exporter of cars to Europe and the rest of Asia. We normally don't think about China as this giant car exporter, but the strange thing, quietly, because they don't export here to the U.S., but quietly, China is going to surpass the U.S. in the coming year as an exporter of cars. I wouldn't have thought that was possible 5 years ago.
You know, one of the things that distinguishes BYD too, Jim, is their emphasis on batteries, right? This is a battery company that happened to become a car company. And I think that is a really interesting place for us to think about the rest of what the auto industry faces. But all of these American companies are coming at it slightly differently than the Chinese have. And the Chinese have a huge advantage in terms of having so much of their infrastructure already in this electric game.
Already there, and also having access to all sorts of, you know, sort of metals, precious metals that are needed to actually build batteries. And what it's doing now is it's forcing American companies to think differently. For example, GM and Ford now are talking about being willing to actually go into deals with lithium producers, which is something that Tesla had not been willing to do, to go in and put money into these companies. They wanted to buy from them, but they didn't want to basically be on the hook for helping support their development. This is a real change, but it's an opportunity that the U.S. has now to grab a bigger piece of that business, because if you don't control batteries, you don't control the future of EVs.
Well, and China still wants to be a big part of tourism, and you guys certainly dug into that as well. And we've been watching it when it comes to some of the gambling names, the U.S. gambling names, but with incredible exposure to Macau. What are we seeing when it comes to tourism and travel? Because that's something you guys certainly covered.
It's been a really tough time because of COVID zero. People have been unable to travel. There have been all sorts of restrictions to the typical places that Chinese tourists would go to. People forget that Chinese tourists had become the number one travelers in Asia, but they were also extremely important travelers in Europe, especially for luxury brands. They love to travel to shop, and it's that was all cut off. International air travel for most people was cut off during the pandemic. Even when it came back for places like Hong Kong, you still had the quarantines, so people didn't take advantage of it. Moreover, intra-China travel, which had been the largest single domestic air market in the world, you know, before the pandemic, that has gone down dramatically. We're only now up to about 35% of what it was before the pandemic. That's a huge drop for a very large market. People are afraid to travel. They hadn't been allowed to travel. Now they're afraid to travel because by ending COVID zero, you've let people jump on planes. You've let people sort of go outside their neighborhoods, but they're not testing anymore. They got rid of the mandatory testing and for masses. And they also are letting people sort of go out without any sort of fix on where they go. They got rid of the right. tracking system. But what that means is this is a country where only 1% of the people have had COVID. There's no herd immunity built in there. So that's the reason why all of a sudden you're saying, oh, 9,000 new cases a day. So, because this is virgin territory for the virus. This is not going to end well.
Right. Hey, Joel, is there some company or some CEO that came up in almost all of your planning meetings when it comes to when you think about companies and business in general?
I mean, can Elon Musk stop making news? It started earlier in the year when we revealed that he actually had amassed a position in Twitter.
Yeah.
And then he acknowledged that and like put forward that he was going to buy it, and $44 billion seemed like a lot of money. And then it really seemed like a lot of money a couple months later as the market sort of started to melt down and he tried to get out of that. And then we had a very entertaining process that ended up eventually with him acquiring the company and tweeting. And maybe you've noticed, it's like he keeps tweeting.
Joel, entertaining is one word.
Hey, here's a hint. I have a feeling you're going to be talking about it in 2023.
We're not going to stop talking about it.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
That's Joel Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, along with another key member of the magazine driving coverage this year, Jim Ellis. He's assistant managing editor.
Coming up, we delve into the major financial headlines of 2022 and the crypto story that just keeps on adding chapters.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec from Bloomberg Radio.
For just the second time ever in 2022, an entire issue of Bloomberg Business Week magazine was dedicated to a single topic from a single writer. Paul Ford's What is Code? You might recall that was the first. That was a few years ago.
Now, this time around, Bloomberg Opinion's Matt Levine gave us 40,000 words on digital assets, a primer on the innovation that could forever change the way that we transact and how we view the world of finance. The October 31st issue was dubbed The Crypto Story, your guide to what it does, what it means, and why it still matters.
Matt did have a helping hand on his way to compiling his definitive digital asset guide, and that came courtesy of Bloomberg Businessweek markets and finance editor Pat Regnier.
Pat joins us now to reflect on that journey, and perhaps he can also try to help us make some sense of the saga that we're continuing to see in this space, headlined, of course, by none other than Sam Bankman-Fried and his now bankrupt crypto exchange, FTX. So, Pat, let's take a look back on how this came together, because here we are at the end of 2022. How did you guys approach this idea of an actual takeover? And how did you settle on, you know, Matt Levine, who I know is familiar to pretty much everybody who's listening right now?
Yeah, well, with things like this, it really started with what does Matt want to do? we were really thinking about how to really get something out of him that people would want to read. He has such a huge following, and he's so crisp and clear on so many issues, from Elon to sort of strange corners of corporate finance. And here we have this topic, crypto, where he was so often writing columns we would read every day, and you would just go, oh, wow, this thing that I didn't understand, now I get it. Because crypto has just been this thing that's moved so quickly that I think people have been kind of like chasing to sort of understand like all of the things that are happening. And so what he did was really kind of explain it from the ground up. And I think in a lot of ways, he ended up foreshadowing a lot of the things that we're talking about now.
What's amazing, you know, too, Pat, when I think about it, we all often say, oh, the crypto world, crypto. And we like kind of throw everything in one basket. And what Matt did is really pull apart the details, dig into everything, specifically provide the transparency I feel like we all needed to kind of understand the relationships and truly what it all meant.
Yeah, I mean, he really starts with kind of explaining like what a blockchain is, which, you know, I'm often surprised. You can talk to somebody for quite a long time and they'll be speaking to you very authoritatively about blockchain. And then you might stop and ask a very basic question and say, you know what, I'm not actually 100% sure I understand that part of it myself. So, you know, it was like very refreshing. It was like, you know, you've been in the desert and somebody gives you a glass of water to sort of just like have somebody finally explain to you some of these fundamentals, which can often be hard to tease out when reading things like white papers that you'll see online where somebody's proposing something. And like, you know, and honestly, a lot of what Matt saw was that underlying a lot of this jargon and talk were, you know, scams and things that would be best described as Ponzi schemes.
I mean, that seems incredibly prescient with what happened, you know, just a couple of weeks after the issue came out. And then what happened in December as well with the arrest of Sam Bankman-Fried and, of course, the collapse of FTX. How do you view the crypto issue in the context of what continues to happen with crypto news that we read about and news that breaks? Like, is this some sort of reference guide for people to go back to and understand current events?
Yeah, I mean, I hope that when people look at it, they'll see it as like, okay, so here's a way to think clearly about all of the things that have happened and all of the little kind of corners and side roads that, you know, this story is going to go into. You know, you look at what Sam Bankman-Fried is accused of doing, and, you know, some of it, there's a simple way of telling the story, and the simple thing is customers sent him money, he took the money, and he moved it over to the hedge fund, and then he lost the money, right? Like, so at one level, you don't have to think about it too hard. But then when you go a little deeper into what he's accused of doing, it gets a lot more complicated and mechanical more quickly. And so, for example, it has to do with, well, what does it mean for something to be a crypto exchange? And how was this exchange using margin and things like that? And the reason that stuff is important to understand is that, you know, Sam Bankman-Fried has been laying the groundwork of a defense of what he's been doing. And it kind of depends a little bit on people being, I think, maybe overwhelmed by some of the detail. And one of the things I hope is that you could read this and then you would have a firm enough grasp on the detail to see through why some of the things that he's saying are just mistakes, maybe could be characterized as something considerably worse than a mistake.
I gotta say, Pat, and nothing against boring white papers, but they're boring. And Matt tells this in such a wonderful read. And then the way you and your team, the graphics, the pictures, the quotes, the polls, like, it's just, it's really pretty incredible to go through. And I'm not going to say it's like reading a novel because it's reality, but it really was a treat and joy to read. And I have to say, you know, we get the magazines in the newsroom and
this, it was hard to find this one.
This was one that everybody was like, do you have the crypto issue? Do you have Matt's crypto issue? Do you have the Business Week crypto issue? Because everybody took it because they wanted to read it and understand it. And I'm curious, what kind of response have you guys gotten from the bigger, broader crypto world or just the world in general?
People have been very positive about it. So they liked it a lot. But I've even heard from people who are some of the strongest crypto critics who said, we really like Matt and the way that he explains these things. That's been kind of heartening that it seems to be well received across people with different opinions about this space, which is now so very much on our mind.
Hey, what's the future here? How do you think about it?
You know, I think that what's happened with FTX is a really existential crisis for crypto. I think, one of the things that Matt lays out at the end of his piece is like, you know, they've built this large, complicated financial system. And the question is it all a Ponzi? Or are they going to build something? And, we're now looking at massive, alleged fraud at the heart of crypto markets. It's not the first one. Huh. That's not only pushing prices down, it's really raising questions about, like, you know, why would you put your money into this? Like, the simplest ways to invest are very, you know, nervous making for people. And, and then we still haven't addressed the question of what are you building? What are you making? I think that's going to be a really, really tough one, especially because, you know, a lot of what's going on with FTX is about the stuff that people thought was building. People would say, well, Bitcoin, like, you know, it doesn't have any intrinsic value. It's just sort of a bet on sort of like a token price going up or down. I mean, that's just like kind of the simple economics of Bitcoin. It's just a pure bet on adoption. But like maybe the next thing that'll happen is people will come up with tokens that give people, you know, utility and kind of represent, you know, some kind of piece of the growth of a company. Well, let's name like one of those tokens. Well, one of those tokens was the token that FTX issued for itself and actually seemed to be a very big part of its collapse.
Right.
So you look at that, it's like, what, you know, what is actually here that people want? And I think like people in the crypto community are going to have they've got a lot of work to do to prove that this isn't just a place to speculate.
Pat, I didn't hear you use the term magic internet money when you were describing that.
Oh, that's for 2023, all right? That's the next full issue. Incredible work. Pat, thanks so much for joining us. Happy New Year.
Thank you.
That's Bloomberg Businessweek Markets and Finance editor Pat Regnier.
Still ahead on the New Year's weekend edition of Bloomberg Businessweek, where U.S. monetary policy goes from here as a year full of wallet-breaking inflation and jumbo interest rate hikes comes to a close. Or does it?
That's the big question. Well, from pandemic labor constraints to the reversal of Roe v. Wade, U.S. women have lost decades worth of progress in just a matter of months, and it's costing the entire country dearly. We're going to explain next. This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing. The passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
In mid-December, we saw Wall Street's hopes for a loosening monetary policy take a big hit. The Federal Reserve did dial back a bit when it raised interest rates by 50 basis points that followed four consecutive 75-point hikes. However, Fed Chair Jay Powell saying officials were not close to ending their aggressive campaign of rate increases and signaled borrowing costs would head higher than expected in 2023. Jay Powell also saying that the central bank would not cut rates until it's confident that inflation is moving back towards its stated 2% inflation goals. Higher interest rates and rising prices have been the prevailing economic themes in America over the past year and really throughout much of the world. To help put it all in context as we head into the new year, let's bring in Bloomberg Businessweek economics editor Christina Lindblad. Christine, I feel like it's been the story that keeps on giving. We just constantly talk about monetary policy in the U.S. and globally. How do you think about the coverage that you guys have done over the year and kind of where we are ending up?
I think about a word that Powell used a lot at the beginning, which is humble, and how the macroeconomics profession has been humbled.
Yeah.
Because nobody really saw this coming and the persistence of it. A few people, I guess, said they would. But here we are. We have a cause, like a glimmer of good news this week with the CPI print, you know, where core inflation at just 0.2% in November. That was the smallest print we've had since August 2021. So maybe the medicine is starting to work, and I think that's what everyone's hoping. I think that's going to be the big thing to watch in 2023.
Well, and speaking of themes, right? Like, I do feel like the Fed has, for the most part, had one message of like, you know, it's about getting inflation, guys, you know, down. And that's what we're focusing on. But at the same time, another theme has been consistently when it comes to the U.S. economy is the strength of the labor market. And that, I guess, gives the Fed some wiggle room, but it's also kind of worrisome, especially when it comes to the wage pressures.
Worrisome. I think it's one of the parts of the puzzle that people can't really figure out. I was saying to somebody that when after the COVID recession, every jobs report, you know, was amazing. You just couldn't believe how fast it was coming back, especially compared to the previous recession after the financial crisis, which we had a long, grinding recovery, right?
Right.
Jobless recovery, it was called. And this was just like, you know, boom, these jobs are coming back. And now, though, we're in this place where when those Friday reports come and they're strong, you know, you avert your eyes and you go, oh, no, you know, because
know.
You know that it means that rates will stay higher for longer. You know, there is still a really, really high level of job openings. Companies are still creating jobs that they say they can't fill. And wage pressure is strong. And at this point now, we're seeing real wage gains because inflation is starting to trend down, but wage growth is still strong. So that's also going to be one of the things that everyone's going to be looking at going into next year.
It feels like, you know, there's data points for everybody. You know, meantime, you know, strong job market that's out there, but we've seen housing slow down. Like, it's very difficult to make sense of it. Having said that, I do feel like you mentioned the last recession coming out of the financial crisis, I think about how the magazine Business Week and you and your team have covered kind of going back to the past. And we have talked a lot about Paul Volcker during the 70s and his inflation fight and what that might mean for what Jay Powell has to do and the Fed.
I think that has been a big shadow, right? A larger than life shadow that has, you know, loomed over Powell and the whole FOMC. There are many similarities, but also many differences in the way everything played out then. Mm-hmm. I think now what haunts them is, you know, the ghost of Arthur Burns, really, who was the Fed chief who thought he'd beaten inflation and then, you know, started loosening too fast. And, you know, we see that Wall Street is perennially hopeful that this pivot will come. And, you know, and they want the pivot to come in 2023. They want the Fed to start cutting rates. Powell pushed back on that, you know, saying that most likely, you know, we see from the new economic projections that the cuts will not happen until 2024.
Well, I know we're going to be talking about this a lot in the new year, no doubt about it. I want to get to another critical development that took place in 2022, and that was the major setback for women's reproductive rights we saw take place with the Supreme Court's reversal of Roe v. Wade. It's a very personal story, but it also made us take a look more broadly at women and their place in their economy and really just kind of the setbacks. Christina, you've been one of the key voices as we unpack the sweeping economic implications of that decision, as is Bloomberg News Equality Team Leader Rebecca Greenfield. And Rebecca, I want to bring you into this conversation as well. Tell us about this issue where you guys did some really deep diving and some deep coverage of what had happened.
Yeah, you know, the Supreme Court made a huge decision and overturned what was almost 50 years of precedent in Roe v. Wade, and it really felt like a very big moment in U.S. history, specifically for women who have made a lot of progress economically and otherwise in the U.S. That seemed to be slipping, and this moment, that decision really felt kind of like a big turning point in the wrong direction for rights and the economy. So we put this breaking point issue where we took the moment to step back and say, what is happening to women in the U.S.?
Well, I have to say, you know, you guys included in this coverage in the magazine, this was back in August, some numbers, 33 million women of childbearing age living in 26 U.S. states expected to institute abortion bans, 24 out of 100,000. The U.S. has the highest maternal mortality rate ratio of any industrialized country, and then $1 trillion projected increase in U.S. GDP over a decade resulting from narrowing the gender divide in labor participation rates to levels prevailing in Europe. Roe v. Wade, very personal, very individual in terms of the impact you think about it. But it's also, there's business implications, economic implications for the setbacks of women that we've seen as of late, Christina.
Also equality. We did a piece in which we looked at decades worth of economic studies that looked at the impact of abortion access. And people have been able to get some very granular information, and they looked at women who were not able to access abortion, you know, had higher chances of being poor, falling into debt, children that were also going to be poor. So it's the impact extends across generations. The Supreme Court decision came at the end of two very trying years for women, right? Mm-hmm. We had something that people called like the she session, because when schools and childcare closed, some women had to quit working, right? And then we had lots of other things. We had, you know, this year we had a formula shortages in the U.S. I mean, who thinks that, you know, a major industrialized, one of the world's top economy, you cannot get formula for your child? There were just kind of these like drip, 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 drip. And then came the Supreme Court thing, which was something that, you know, people had posited for a while, and there was even this leaked decision, but it was still was a shock.
Rebecca, as you guys rolled out the coverage, I mean, what just kind of stood out for you in doing this series of stories?
Yes, I think the biggest thing that has stood out for me since the decision and was a big part of the coverage is that the way that the decision has played out is that it's really not solely about abortion and safe abortion and the economic implications of that, but it's really becoming an issue of safe pregnancy and maternal health. And that really seems to be the really big risk that women face. There are safer ways for women to get abortions in places where it's not legal than 50 years ago. That's true. And we've written about that. And even in the places that have these near total abortion bans, but they're having these ripple effects on women who have wanted pregnancies that need to get medical care. That is an abortion, but it's not technically legal, or it's not clear if it's legal. And we ran a big story by Claire Sedis about maternal mortality rates there, which are very high in the U.S. for a developed country, and particularly high in parts of the U.S. And she zeroed in on this rural area in Texas. But we've seen so many more stories since then in places that aren't, you know, completely in the middle, you know, with very little health care, where people who want to have children but are running up against these laws. And it's very scary.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. And I have to say, with something that I always find Bloomberg Business Week does so well, like, you'll tell the big macro story and the data or the research behind it, but you also always have individuals, so that, you know, it's so easy to get lost in the data, Rebecca. But I feel like when you drill down and you tell individual stories, like, we all can relate to it.
Yeah.
That was the year that was for women. It led to the Breaking Point Business Week cover story that was out back in August. We're going to continue with Christina and Rebecca about what 2023 may have in store when it comes to women gaining back some of their lost prosperity. We'll have more when our New Year's holiday weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week continues. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovek from Bloomberg Radio.
Continuing our important discussion about what's next for women in the United States following the landmark reversal of Roe v. Wade earlier this year, we spin it forward, and we're still talking with Bloomberg News Equality team leader Rebecca Greenfield and Bloomberg Businessweek economics editor Christina Lindblad. Guys, you know, coming off the midterms, I think we were all just kind of watching so closely to see how it played out. I do wonder, midterm outcome and then thinking ahead to the next presidential election. Rebecca, let me start with you. Do you think things could change for the better when it comes to women?
Great question. We hope so. So the election was super interesting because abortion ended up being such a big issue for voters. There were a bunch of referendums in some states that specifically asked voters what they thought about abortion, if they wanted it to be legal. All of them indicated, yes, people want abortion protections. That also helped some Democratic candidates in those states and in other places win in a year where a lot of people expected, you know, just the usual thing to happen, where the other party that's not in power, the Republicans, to get more votes. So it was a really big galvanizing issue. So the election in and of itself was super interesting from that.
Absolutely. Christina, come on in on it. You know, as you
It's what we want, right? We want to codify
yes.
them to law.
Yes.
For years, we lived this time waiting for a challenge to this precedent that might bring it down, right? It was always a possibility. So I am heartened by the results of the midterms. It showed that reproductive rights were an issue in voters' minds. So I was very heartened by that.
As we know, politics can go a lot of different ways and funny ways. When you look at 2023, and I do feel like there's a lot of the issues that we talked about in 2022 that will obviously continue into the new year. But Rebecca, what's kind of front and center for you?
definitely still abortion. Things are really shaking out, even in states where we had predicted that there were these trigger ban laws. There's a lot of lawsuits. There's a lot of challenges and ballot measures, even in very deep red states. That's going to continue to play out. And then I think that there's this like 3-year long fatigue of especially working parents and working moms. There has not been any solution to that. Nothing has been floated. Things that have been floated have fallen through. So it's just something we're always looking for and seeing if it will happen, if they'll bring anything back or can get anything passed to help working parents.
Christina, what's kind of front and center for you as you think about 2023?
Well, I think for me, it's looking at this possibility of recession, but also a job market that has defied expectations. Stories that we've done talking to employers in which companies that had trouble staffing up after the COVID lockdowns are saying we're going to think twice and three times before laying off people in a downturn. You know what I mean? Not so fast. Of course, it could still happen. But I mean, I think that it's sort of people look at their sort of inputs of production. They really realize how important labor is in the equation. And, now as we have an economy that's kind of skewed highly towards services. So recession and for me and the labor market. And just to also dial back to what Rebecca was saying, in terms of childcare, we have something looming that's a negative, which is money that was in the Biden stimulus for daycare centers, and it was quite a chunk. That money is going to dry up going into like at the end of this year and the beginning of the year. And, we've talked to some childcare providers and they're saying they don't know how, they gave their staff wage increases to hang on to them because they were losing them to warehouse jobs, other, higher paying jobs. And they say, we don't know how we're going to be able to cope without this aid.
And that has a huge impact. And you think about the implications of that. I know we could talk a lot longer on this and looking forward to your coverage, both of you, when it comes to Business Week's coverage in 2023. Thank you so much and Happy New Year. Bloomberg Business Week economics editor Christina Lindblad and Bloomberg News Equality team leader Rebecca Greenfield always appreciate their thoughtful coverage and reporting. And that wraps up the first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. I'm Carol Masser. Tim Stanovec back with me as we take a dive in the next hour down the big tech rabbit hole. Ahead in our next hour, Elon and Tesla, Meta and Mark, EV explosions, and a museum in the desert for the lucky few. Tech and pursuits, they're coming up next in our holiday weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine, plus global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Tim Stenebeck on Bloomberg Radio.
Plenty ahead in our second hour of this holiday weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week, including the electric vehicles that are just so cool and so expensive, they just aren't meant for the masses. They're just not for you and me, Tim.
Not yet. That's part of the issue. Plus, fine art from the Nevada desert and all the way to the canals of Venice. And plenty of glitz and glamour in between. We celebrate the best of Bloomberg Pursuits in 2022.
First up this hour, we mentioned EVs earlier, the last hour. We spoke about them at the top with Joel Weber and Jim Ellis. And Joel mentioned the man that may be most synonymous with electrified transport on this planet. You know what we're talking about? Elon Musk.
Except Musk's ultra-valuable EV empire at Tesla did not appear at the top of his agenda for much of the past year. Instead, it was his $44 billion purchase of the social media platform Twitter.
To help us make sense of what Musk really accomplished with his takeover, as well as some other key takeaways from the world of technology over the past 12 months, let's bring in Bloomberg Businessweek columnist Max Chafkin. Max, I feel like there was so much to cover this past year, but a lot of it did feel like every day there was something with Elon Musk.
Yeah, you know, we've been writing stories here and other publications have too over the last almost like a decade about how poorly run Twitter has been. You know, it's this incredibly culturally salient service. You know, obviously
we love it.
It sets the news agenda. Journalists are addicted to it, but it has really struggled for a very long time to turn itself into a successful business. And I guess over the last year, we've just seen maybe, you know, comparatively, they were doing actually a pretty good job because Elon Musk, you know, world's greatest entrepreneur, according to many people, you know, super respected innovator, has for whatever reason, maybe these are problems of his own making, or maybe these are actually some of the challenges with Twitter, has really, really, really struggled to run this thing. And we have just watched kind of this rolling series of kind of media circus slash disaster. It almost feels like, you know, the political version of like the first 6 months of the Trump presidency or something, where you kind of can't look away. He's just dominating the conversation. But it's also not totally clear what exactly is being accomplished.
You kind of took the words right out of my mouth, because in reading your columns over the past few months, as Elon Musk has spent more time on Twitter, one thing that comes to mind is the way that he interacts with people tweeting about him. And it actually is similar to what we saw from President Trump when he was on Twitter. Talk to us a little bit about this idea that Elon Musk is kind of like amplifying his own voice in several different ways through fan accounts on Twitter.
Yeah. So Musk has long had this kind of army of followers. But as he's become more active on Twitter and as he's sort of, I think, like leaned into this mode of conversation, which involves, as you said, interacting with these fan accounts. Also, you know, he talks to kind of these quote bot accounts that post, you know, notable things he said. It's a quote from Elon Musk. Elon Musk chimes in and says, "Well said." And you know, fans, anyone who comes in and says, you know, you're a genius or you're being persecuted or any number of things, you know, Musk is right there to buck them up. Now, that's, I think, actually a pretty good strategy from a sort of marketing perspective. Musk is, I think, even still, even with all the challenges at Tesla and Twitter, a really great marketer, kind of with an intuitive marketing sense, kind of like, I would argue, Trump. But stuck in the kind of bubble of Twitter, we've sort of seen the kinds of things that I think happen to a lot of us if we spend too much time on Twitter kind of happen to Elon Musk, where it almost feels like he's consumed with this ultimately meaningless conversation and maybe taking his eye off some more important issues. You know, one of which is this rocket company that he's running that's trying to get to Mars, and the other, of course, is this electric car company that, you know, faces some serious challenges. And I think we're seeing investors and maybe even car buyers react to that.
I always feel like when there's a headline on Elon Musk, I'm always like, oh, Elon, because it's like this weird individual who you have to give him his props in terms of pushing EVs out into the market much sooner than everybody thought. The way he thinks, whether it's SpaceX, whether it's the Boring Company, he really moves the needle on things and really thinks in a different way. At the same time, I've never seen a CEO of a publicly held company go out on Twitter and say things that could financially impact, you know, his company. Like, how do you get your head around this?
Well, Musk, you know, has always had this larger-than-life persona, has given him a lot of power. And, you know, over the years, we've seen that sometimes create controversy. You know, with Tesla, when Tesla bought SolarCity, like, there was a bunch of lawsuits. It kind of looked like self-dealing. You have a situation where Elon Musk can basically do whatever the heck he wants at these companies, which is something you see across, you know, other tech companies. Now, it almost feels like with Twitter, he reached escape velocity or whatever, where It's not only does he have complete control, not only does he own it, but he's sort of operating with no kind of controls at all. Where, you know, where he came in with basically a bunch of his friends as his, you know, executive team. And it really looked kind of like an army of basically Elon fanboys. And, you know, that is not even the greatest executives, even the greatest marketers, I think need good advice and maybe need to hear criticism. And I think that has been a place where Musk struggled.
Can I just ask, how do you think about 2023 for Elon Musk?
Well, I think there are a couple of questions. Like, one is, you know, if you want Twitter to survive and thrive, you're sort of hoping he loses interest. He, you know, maybe he like cedes some day-to-day control to people who actually know what they're doing, or maybe he just kind of takes his foot off the gas a little bit and just, instead of trying to constantly stir the pot, just tries to run this thing more efficiently. You know, he is capable of that. And I think, you know, one thing we have seen at Twitter is that, yes, like, he's laid off huge numbers of people. There've been lots of resignations, but some people have stuck around because even for all the craziness, Elon Musk is still a business hero, and people want to work for him, even with all the downsides. The other thing that I think is probably the more important question is Tesla, because, you know, Tesla, for years and years, people have been talking about these other car companies are going to have EVs that are going to be just as good as Tesla. You know, other car companies have advantages that Tesla does not have, service, marketing. And you have these competitive car companies coming. You have China being a huge source of uncertainty. China's super important to Tesla. And then you have Elon Musk lighting basically his main asset on fire, which is his reputation as a brand. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is going to create real challenges for Tesla and could lead to some disruption in the EV market if Elon Musk doesn't find a way to kind of grab control.
All right. You said Meta, so we got to go there. You didn't say Facebook, which I thought was really interesting and also telling for one of your recent columns about how Mark Zuckerberg.
It's now known as Meta Platforms.
It is, but I mean, for anyone who's covered this company for its entire existence, you understand that the core business is still the business that makes money, and it's still the business that investors are punishing right now.
Well, I mean, it's like, speaking of potential CEO incompetence, I mean, the crazy thing about the Elon Musk tenure is he's kind of made Mark Zuckerberg look good. And I feel like if Elon Musk had not, you know, had such a crazy 2022, we'd be talking about Mark Zuckerberg. How could somebody take this amazing asset? Facebook is an amazing service. You know, 3 billion people a day are using this thing. It's like half the world's population. It is a marketing engine like nothing the world has ever seen. And Zuckerberg, basically about a year ago, decided, no, I'm done with that. We're going to have, you know, meeting rooms with no avatars and no legs. We're going to have, you know, Second Life. But Facebook version. And, you know, people have responded to that kind of the way that you would expect them to respond to that, which is they don't care. And, you know, Facebook spent all this money, you know, on Super Bowl ads. They ran a Super Bowl ad in February. Zuckerberg goes on the Joe Rogan podcast, you know, biggest podcast in the world, one of the most influential radio shows there is. No one cares. And we're talking about, you know, hundreds of thousands of people using this thing called Horizon Worlds, despite the fact that Facebook has spent, you know, something like $30 billion. And that, of course, has severely damaged the stock. You know, it's led to all sorts of questions about Mark Zuckerberg's leadership ability, because, again, just like with Musk, you have this guy who is basically the absolute ruler of the company, and suddenly, you know, maybe for the first time ever, seems not up to the task. And that is, I mean, that maybe that's one of the big themes of 2022. We've seen these kind of, you know, great leaders stumble in ways that they haven't stumbled before.
Max, another theme of this past year has been, you know, the slump that we've seen in digital advertising. Is that part of the problem? If we weren't in that slump and the economic conditions that have created that slump, that maybe Meta wouldn't be in such a tough place, that it would be better and we'd be all kind of more willing to deal with Zuckerberg changing
absolutely.
The company.
And there are other factors here. Of course, you mentioned the slowdown in digital advertising. You know, if Mark Zuckerberg were right here, he'd be, you know, saying, you know, Tim Cook and coughing, because, of course, Apple has changed a bunch of the rules around digital advertising in ways that have impacted Facebook's business. Now, I do think, broadly speaking, though, what is happening is during COVID, during the pandemic, there was a lot more usage of these digital services, and digital advertising, you know, spiked, you know, suddenly, partly because people were spending more time, partly because there was more money to be, you know, people were just spending their, you know, stimulus checks or whatever. And that has gone away. We're going back to something that looks like the way it was before. But like, if you're Mark Zuckerberg, the way it was before was pretty good. I mean, you look at Facebook in 2019, mm-hmm. and that was a dominant, successful company. And I think the argument that, you know, maybe they should have, instead of investing or losing really billions of dollars on the metaverse, maybe they could have just, you know, tried to shore up the core business. That's something that you're seeing investors increasingly kind of bring up. Although, again, you know, people still do believe in Mark Zuckerberg, and you do still hear people talking about the promise of the metaverse. So, you know, it's possible that this thing will eventually come to fruition, although it has not, you know, been a good year for Zuckerberg.
I'm cool with the metaverse as long as I have my avatar has legs. That's all I'm saying. I like my legs. Right. Also, check out, Max has done some great reporting on Sam Bankman-Fried, FTX, including the FUD behind the crypto collapse. That was a really great story. Max Chafkin, columnist for the magazine, covering so many different things, and of course, all things tech. Max, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, we hit the road with our Bloomberg Pursuits team and check out some sweet rides and amazing art.
We do indeed. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec from Bloomberg Radio.
All right, time for baubles and Bugattis, museums and Maseratis, and many awe-inspiring and just really cool things in between. You like what I did there, didn't you?
I did.
That's Chris Rouser.
Chris Rouser is the editor of Bloomberg Pursuits. You can hear him chuckling at the great writing that Carol just read.
Alliteration, writing 101.
We're also joined by our intrepid auto columnist, Hannah Elliott. Every week, a trip into the world of wow and wonderful. We do that in the world of Bloomberg Pursuits. So, Chris, how, you know, going into the end of the year, thinking about everything that Hannah has done throughout the year and throughout, well, I mean, I don't want to put too much pressure on you.
Do you ever say no to Hannah? That's what I want to know.
Throughout her career, how are you thinking about the end of the year issue?
You know, Hannah has maybe the coolest job of anyone in this
building.
She's
here, you know. We're talking about her, and she's here.
Hannah,
yes,
I'm talking about
her. Yes, I agree. I do agree.
Right in front of her. And, you know, she test drives all these incredible cars, but she also has like a bird's eye view into the whole industry, especially when it comes to luxury cars and where the industry's going, electric vehicles. And, you know, she was talking about the cars that she reviewed this year, and she was talking about how she crab walked with like the electric Hummer through the desert, and she drives these incredible Porsches. And it was just so fun to think about everything that she's tried out and everything that she's seen this year. So we had a lot of fun looking back at the year with her favorite cars.
Well, speaking of cars, I mean, I do feel like EVs are, there's going to be a lot of buying next year. But how do you think about it from your vantage point, Hannah?
Well, I have to say, I was so happy this year with the offerings from the EV world. I mean, for so long, of course, it's been Tesla. And then, you know, we had like a Prius as a hybrid and some other sort of minor things. But this is the first year that really the luxury automakers gave us some real options in the EV world. I mean, Audi has their e-tron line, which includes a small sedan and then like a hatchback thing and an SUV. BMW gave us multiple sedan and SUV EVs. We're seeing a whole EQ line from Mercedes of EVs. So this is the first year where it has really felt like, wow, we have a lot of options. And I think it's been really interesting that as, you know, we start to hear some people say, I'm not feeling so hot about Tesla cars. You know, for many reasons, people are kind of ready to like, what else is there? And finally, we actually do have a lot of things to choose from.
And we talk about this all the time in Pursuits because luxury, people don't always realize the way that luxury can define the rest of an industry. You may remember Miranda's cerulean monologue from The Devil Wears Prada. But Tesla really, you know, it taught people that an EV doesn't have to look like a lozenge. It doesn't have to look like a toaster that you're driving, you know, and we're hoping that people are learning about that this year. You know, Hannah has all these prescriptions that she thinks that should happen in the next year. So not only like electric cars are going to look better, they're going to drive better, they're going to have better luxury quality, but also they need to be cheaper, right, Hannah?
Yeah. You know, I remember writing that story and, you know, the average price of an EV is almost $70,000, where the average price of a regular electric new car is closer to $48,000. So there's still a really big price disparity. And it is true at the moment that typically EVs are driven by wealthier people. Well, if EVs are going to save the world, they need to be driven by a wide range of people. It's not just about getting more high-priced EVs in the market, even though personally that's what I love. it is really about, you know, giving a broad range from very affordable to, of course, a lot of options.
Is this the one with a refrigerated champagne cooler?
I think many of them have a refrigerated champagne cooler.
See, I know nothing. I drive a wagon. What do I know?
Standard issue Rolls Royce paraphernalia right there.
It's interesting, Hannah, because you don't, you know, there's a lot of people who don't drive EVs, I think, are worried about range. They have range anxiety. But as you write in one of your recent pieces, most Americans are only driving, what, fewer than 40 miles a day. So it's not necessarily that you need a longer range, but you still write that you need charging to be better. What do you mean by that?
Right. That's a great point. I think now really what I hear and what I experience when I drive these EVs is not really range anxiety. It's more about charging anxiety. And what I mean by that is the availability of chargers once you get there, that they're not broken, they're not occupied, and they're not going to take you 12 hours to charge. All of those are things that, yes, have to do with the network, the charging network that we need to improve, but also with charge times that these EVs can have. Once they can charge quicker and quicker and quicker, that will really alleviate a lot of the anxiety that consumers have around EVs, not just with range, but also with what is very valuable, time.
Yeah, and that's also an access thing, right? I mean, that's also more people can have it when that's more robust. Now, something we also talk about a lot is that the most green thing you can do is not even buy a new car; it's buy an old car, which brings
this
up
this is my favorite thing,
which brings up one of me and Hannah's favorite websites, which is bringatrailer.com.
You, Hannah, and my dad.
Yeah, there's probably
lots of dads, right?
Not a week that goes by that Hannah doesn't send me a listing of a Jeep Grand Wagoneer that she says that I should buy.
You need this. It is very addicting.
And it's done incredibly well this year, right, Hannah?
It has done insane. Bring a Trailer was formed about 10 years ago. This year, they already cleared $1 billion in sales. And they are on track to do about $1.3 billion in sales this year, which is astounding. Now, Bring a Trailer, of course, is the online auction website where you can search for any car, basically, and you can join a live auction and see bids put in real time and quotes, comments, and people talking about the car in real time. It's really addictive, and it's really fun. And the beauty of it is, the fees are so low, so it's really beat this old auction model of selling cars live, you know, under auction tents. It's really fast, it's cheap, and it's really fun.
I think people have, this idea that the types of cars available on Bring a Trailer are those really inaccessible vehicles, stuff that's super expensive. But you write that there's really, you know, it really runs the gamut.
Oh, there's something for everyone. I mean, I get on and look. I mean, Chris knows I've been a little bit obsessed with old Corvettes, like C3 Corvettes. Mm-hmm. You can get on and find, you know, an old Corvette for $10,000. You can look for old Broncos. You can look for old BMW wagons, which actually are kind of going up in value. There's something for everyone again, and I think that's why it's so popular. Even if you're not actively bidding, you kind of think you could, because not everything is that expensive, and it's really fun to get on and just live vicariously through whatever auction you're following at the moment.
What's really cool is it sounds like that's why this individual, right, the founder of the company,
Randy
making
Nonnenberg.
Right, the Bloomberg 50 on the list this year.
Yeah, I'm really happy that he has been on the list, because the point of the Bloomberg 50 is to really highlight people who have upended their industries. And Randy really did that. You know, he comes from, he worked at a BMW dealership in Northern California, and he and some friends were sort of just trading car listings back and forth to each other, which is kind of how this idea was born. And he has really transformed the industry, like I said, with something that is really accessible, easy, you get instant gratification, and it has forced the other auction houses like Gooding, RM Sotheby's, Bonhams to come up with their own ways of selling cars online. He really showed this is a lucrative endeavor, and it's forced the other guys to kind of follow suit.
All right, rapid round. Yes or no? Hannah, you could buy in a car this year, this coming year?
No, I can't. I already bought two. I bought one last year.
Chris Rouser?
No, I just need a vehicle that can transport a toddler, and I already have that.
Tim?
No way.
All right.
I'm happy with the
We're
Subaru.
City people here.
Subaru.
It's so sad.
Carol, will you?
I don't know. I've got a 19-year-old who's like, I got my license. It's time for a car. So we'll
Maybe
see.
She should buy the car.
TBD. Guys, thank you so much. Happy New Year. Happy holidays. Our thanks to Bloomberg Pursuits auto columnist Hannah Elliott for all of her great work. We love reading her columns this year, and we look forward to what's to come in 2023.
Still to come on Bloomberg Business Week, Chris Rouser sticking with us. We're going to dive into the even pricier world of fine art.
This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovek from Bloomberg Radio.
It wouldn't be a best of Bloomberg Pursuits discussion if we didn't highlight some of the work and travel of our great arts columnist, James Tarmey. He is pretty incredible. You know that?
Are you just saying that because he's with us right now?
Kind of.
Okay. No. Well, he is with us. He's right next to me.
I love.
You know, just keep it coming, please.
In addition to James, we were also really pleased to have back with us Bloomberg Pursuits editor, Chris Rouser, who's going to take us inside some of the most exclusive places in the art world and beyond. Time to go mine some art. Chris, I want to start with you because you oversee the Pursuits section and kind of just how your approach this year went in the context of what James does in art.
Well, the amazing thing about the Pursuits team is they have an incredible level of access. So when James goes to art fairs, for example, he knows all of the gallerists and he knows some of the artists and he gets invited into everything. And one of the coolest things he did this year was he was the second journalist to go into The City, which is this giant, incredible art creation in the Nevada desert. And he was really the first journalist to go around and talk about what it was like to be there. So we have all these incredible opportunities for coverage because James is such an expert and knows so many people.
Was that like your favorite moment of the year?
Really, it was one of these singular bucket list experiences that I had obviously known about for a while because what we're talking about is this art installation in the Nevada desert that has been under construction for 50 years. So not exactly a secret, but something that no one was allowed into, at least professionally, for a really, really long time. So it had been on my radar. And basically this year they have finally started allowing people inside and I had been dying to go and managed to actually make the trek.
So what was it like?
So getting there is a whole thing. You know, it's around 3 hours from Las Vegas, but the first hour and a half, you're on highway, fine, smooth sailing. But then you get to this town of Alamo and you get into this kind of tricked out SUV and you spend the next hour and a half driving through the desert. And then you sort of appear at this massive installation, which at first you don't realize that it's there because most of it is excavated underground. So then you kind of get into it and all of a sudden you realize that you're in something that doesn't look like anything you've ever seen before, basically. It's utterly quiet because you're there totally by yourself. While I was walking through it, I began to figure out what the artist was trying to do, which is create a maximalist form of minimalism, which sounds sort of abstract, but in reality, he was able to take the contours of the earth and create this kind of exquisite, almost three-dimensional painting out of it.
Tell us about the artist and his history in land art.
Yeah, so he is a progenitor of this.
This is Michael Heiser.
This is Michael Heiser. He is sort of a like a cowboy. A whole part of land art was like saying that New York galleries were way too fancy and pop art was way too glitzy, and they wanted to kind of go back into nature and impress themselves upon the land. So, of course, the New York galleries are paying for all of this, but let's not focus too much on that. But he dug these huge trenches in a mesa, and he's done these kind of concrete indentations in California. He's very much a person who not only places his own idea of minimalism on the land, but he gets people behind it, and he gets people to kind of get extremely excited about it and fund all of his crazy endeavors. And this is really the craziest of them all.
Was there any risk that once you took the trip that there's a chance that you couldn't have gone to see it, or they wouldn't have let you in the end?
Actually, I was delayed a couple of days because it rained, which is an unusual thing.
Okay.
And it washed out the road and made it totally impassable. But no, once I had been kind of locked into going, it was all prearranged. The thing was that they kept saying no for a really, really, really long time.
Yeah.
Until they finally said yes, and I called up Chris and I was like, I'm getting on a plane.
Can we go now or no?
Good luck, Carol.
Well,
who do you know?
And what does it cost? And
so it costs very little, I think. Okay. Around $150, and that's just for the cost of transportation that they provide for you. But that assumes that you're in Las Vegas, which is not necessarily the case. When it was announced that it was open to the public, around 10,000 people applied to visit in the first week.
Oh my God.
It is very, very sought after thing, and their whole attitude about it is that people should be able to have the experience that I had, which is this kind of quiet, solitary, multi-hour long experience in it. And that means that they're really limiting how many people can come in at any time.
Mm.
Moreover, they don't let people in when it's bad weather or when it's raining because they just can't get there. So you can go, but there's a bit of wait that you'll have to expect to be able to make. But the good news is it's there and it's not going anywhere.
Well, speaking of something that's there and finally back is the Venice Biennale. Long delayed due to COVID. You got to go there as well. How were the themes this year in terms of, you know, how they're thinking about the year?
Let me just say that the Venice Biennale is why I have stayed an art journalist. It is absolutely the most fun because they turn over the entire city of Venice to art. Mm-hmm. So you get to go into these private homes. You get to see all of the most cutting-edge artworks, which countries from around the world have brought. You get to kind of traipse through the Giardini, looking at these different pavilions filled with different national efforts. It's a huge deal. And beyond it simply being fun, it's actually super, super, super important, because what it does is it charts basically the way that the rest of the art world is going to go for the next several years. It's a way of seeing what's going to be next. And so for a while, the art world had been really inward-looking, or maybe not even inward-looking in the art world itself, but inward-looking on the people who are making the art. Very much about identity politics, very much about nationality and background and biography. That has really begun to change. First, it began to change in Venice, and now we're actually seeing it change in the art market itself. In Venice, it was all about the future. It was about ecology, it was about climate change. Very, very interesting, because it was trying to take an artistic perspective and really apply it to something that affects everyone. And sometimes it was successful and sometimes it wasn't, but it was very different than what we've been seeing for a while.
There is one story I want to get to that you did this past year, James, and I feel like this is near and dear also to Chris, and this has to do with watches, Sotheby's, Pablo Picasso's. So Chris, first of all, this story, I mean, watches, you guys do a lot of coverage. We know you love them, but they have become quite the investment.
Watches have had a kind of up and down year this year. They became huge in the past couple of years on the secondary market, which is people buying pre-owned watches online or at auction. And that was partially fueled by like the crypto craze. It was very much like a speculation thing and also a pride thing. And prices have softened in the second half of the year, which is good, I think. But Christie's and Sotheby's and the other auction houses have really started focusing on luxury, because the whole secondhand market, from bags to cars to watches to jewelry, has really, really boomed. And they're, you know, they don't make as much money on a particular piece. Like a Patek is not going to go up for as much as a Picasso, But there's a lot more Pateks out there than there are Picassos, and it's easier to play a volume game with them. So James talked to the CEO of Sotheby's about their whole luxury strategy, which has really evolved in the past couple of years.
It's interesting because for a while, quote-unquote luxury was something that was very much less than, less prestigious, less interesting, less volume, less room for growth than art for a lot of these auction houses. And they realized relatively recently that actually this was a huge growth market that they could really tap into. And that coincided with, of course, a lot of people bored at home during COVID buying stuff. And there was a supply shock, right?
Yeah.
If everyone all of a sudden has extra money because they're not spending it on travel or restaurants, and everyone decides that, it, you know, they're going to treat themselves to a fancy watch. Well, there's only a finite number of fancy watches out there, as Chris can talk about. So ultimately, auction houses became a major beneficiary of people realizing that if they wanted a fancy watch, they were going to have to buy a used one. And that has become not only a source of growth for these auction houses, but a real strategy for the way that these auction houses are charting their course over the next couple of years.
Gotta say, I can't wait for the coverage, Pursuits coverage in the coming year. It's always a fun thing, and we love kind of sitting in here and just chatting with you guys all about it. So looking forward to it.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you. Happy New Year.
That's Bloomberg Pursuits editor Chris Rouser, along with arts columnist James Tarmey. Another amazing year of work from the entire team, guys, and we really barely scratched the surface, Carol.
Yeah, so much there to cover. Check it all out online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. Our deepest thanks to Chris, James, and all the other great individuals we get to work with, Jim Gaddy, Kate Crater, Hannah Elliott, and of course, our undercover reporter, Brandon Presser, just to name a few. He's always worth a read, always worth a giggle, and we just love reading your work and being able to bring it out to the world.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, we wrap up our New Year's weekend programming with some final thoughts from the editor of the magazine, Joel Weber.
This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovek from Bloomberg Radio.
We wrap up our New Year's holiday weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week, and with it, we want to bring back the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, Joel Weber. Joel, so much we talked about. The top, China, we talked about Elon, a lot of important stories from the past year, that whole issue devoted to crypto. How are you thinking about 2023 already?
Look, I think we spent a lot of time talking about crypto this year, and I don't think that story is over. You know, an interesting thing here, there was a cover story we did middle of the year about the Lehman Brothers saga. We are more than a decade after Lehman. We're still unwinding Lehman. And that story was about the consultants who come in and basically are squeezing every last dime out of the estate of Lehman Brothers, right? And here we are with crypto. I don't know if it's going to last 10 more years to squeeze everything out that was there. But we are going through something, this crypto winter that we've been documenting all year, culminates with the crypto story by Matt Levine in the magazine, covered cover issue. And in that time since then, look, you've got the FTX implosion. You've got more quakes, and it just feels like this industry that has been growing for a decade, but now it sort of feels on far shakier ground. So I don't think we're nearly done covering crypto next year. As a business journalist, it excites me because there's going to be much more to say, many more developments, and I don't begin to have a clue what those could look like, but we'll be there. But that also ties into, I think, another big topic here, which is the global economy and the American economy and what we're now living through in terms of interest rates increases. It just speaks to what the economy, we're all going to be talking about this more next year. Mm-hmm. And the R word, recession, is one that we've been talking about a lot. But like whether or not America falls into recession, if it manages to stay out of it, if there's this soft landing, like we're not nearly done talking about Jay Powell and the Fed or inflation, right? So that's going to be a topic of conversation. And boy, I hope we get to talk about markets going up rather than down, because that was all we got to really do this year.
Well, Joel, it's the short sellers calling, and they're really ticked off at you.
Well, that's my question, though, and specifically about technology, because if we think about sort of one change that we saw in 2022, it was layoffs in Silicon Valley, the potential that tech sort of loses its mantle as being, you know, one of the main drivers and engines of this economy. And I'm not saying it's going to necessarily lose that, but it's not what it was in the era of low interest rates.
look, like, I think we are having an existential moment right now. I don't think that the tech industry is going away anytime soon, but I do think the valuations that we saw, the lack of profitability that a lot of these companies have had, we're in a moment now where when the cost of money becomes exponentially greater, the appetite for risk comes down, and ROI becomes a consideration that probably hasn't been when money was free. So I think we are just in a tough spot for a second, and it's going to challenge a lot of very smart people to really, really push for things that matter. So I think it's going to be an exciting time to watch. We're not nearly done with it. You think about some of the strides that have been made and where things like artificial intelligence could or could not go. It's going to be a wonder. It's a really exciting time to be alive and see where some of this stuff goes. And I, in general, I am an optimist. So I hope that we can have more sun and less clouds next year. But it also does speak to, like, back to the crypto idea. Something that largely, like, what's it for again? You know, like, is that going to be a thing that can continue to endure, or are we in a much more rational, tangible version of reality?
Well, one of the best parts of our job is getting to work with you each mm-hmm. and every day. That's Bloomberg Businessweek editor Joel Weber, who is with us once again, a constant for us and the head of one of the best business publications in the world. I'm going to go ahead and say the best business
yep.
publication.
Love it.
We love working with you and the team, and thank you so much for joining us this year.
Happy New Year, Joel.
Thank you.
And that wraps up the weekend edition, our holiday weekend edition, our New Year's edition of Bloomberg Businessweek from Bloomberg Radio. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovic. Be sure to tune in to Bloomberg Businessweek Monday through Friday starting at 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio.
You can also watch our daily broadcast. Check us out on YouTube. Just search Bloomberg Global News.
And check out our Bloomberg Businessweek podcast. You can find that at Bloomberg.com, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Businessweek available on newsstands now at Bloomberg.com/businessweek and always on the Bloomberg terminal.
You can also check us out on Bloomberg Quick Take available at Bloomberg.com/QT and streaming platforms like Roku, Apple TV, Samsung TV, and more. Happy New Year, everyone.
Be well, world. This is Bloomberg.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.